We've had 40 years of rising debt to GDP, but it's been offset by 40 years of falling interest rates until we hit zero. And so if we just go, you know, sideways now, let alone up, but if we just go sideways, then we no longer have that offset of interest rates compared to the debt. And I think the pendulum has swung so far that now people are in the mindset that debts and deficits don't really matter. And it's starting to matter.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Aura, the all-in-one application that protects your safety online powered by AI. Honestly, it is worse to just be a human that exists on the internet from a safety perspective than it ever has been before. I'm constantly getting weird scam phone calls from everyone. I'm sure you guys do too. There are lots of weird phishing attempts that are made to internal employees at Blockworks and on Twitter. So I have to do these posts that, hey, I'll never ask you for money. It just is terrible. The actual statistics is that 1 in 4 people now fall victim to cybercrime. And if you operate in crypto, it is even worse. You are more at risk. That's why we're happy to partner up with Aura here. And I'm going to be telling you all about them later in the show. Hey, everyone. This episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety first L2, accelerating the transition to an on-chain financial system. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the episode. But for now, on with the program. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of On the Margin. Today I'm joined by repeat guest Lynn Alden and Luke Roman. I'm really, really excited for this one. And, you know, with the two of you, it's almost a challenge. You cover such breadth of knowledge. It's almost a challenge to figure out exactly where to start. But I think I want to start with this chart that Dan Tapiero recently tweeted out. And it sort of got me thinking because I think it sits at the intersection of a lot of really interesting stuff that's going on in the macro world right now. So what we're looking at here is a chart that covers the U.S. 10-year real rate inverted versus gold. And historically, you know, that we know that gold behaves in inversely correlated way to real rates. And you can see by this chart going all the way back to 2006 that this relationship holds pretty strong. But starting in 2022, there's been a real divergence where gold has deviated significantly to the upside at a time where real rates are headed in exactly the opposite direction. And so I'm curious, just looking at this chart and frankly, just the behavior of gold, you know, in the last year and a half or so. And what are your guys' takeaways here?
To me, I think it's a couple of things. I think first, you had the seizure of Russian FX reserves in early 22. And I think that kind of started the divergence where all of a sudden it began to raise some question about the safety of U.S. Treasury bonds as FX reserves, as the global geopolitical situation gets more touchy. And then it really diverged, if you look at the chart, in my opinion, in 3Q22, when Yellen went to the IMF in Washington in October. They had their semi-annual meetings. Bloomberg talked about that the dollar was a big topic of conversation, the strong dollar. If you remember, the dollar was around 114 at the time. We had just had a 10-year treasury auction with, if I remember right, a three or four basis point tail. It was the latest in a series of ugly treasury auctions. Markets were not doing well. And coming out of that meeting, we saw Yellen begin to run the treasury general account down from October 22 into the first quarter of 23. Dramatically, more than offsetting the QT that Powell was doing, basically injecting net dollar liquidity. And I think that really jump-started that divergence because I think it was Goldmarket was basically saying, okay, Yellen just confirmed to us that the United States cannot have its treasury market function with positive real rates, and when push comes to shove, they will support the treasury market over the currency. I need to own more gold, regardless of what real rates are doing. I also think part and parcel to that, we've been seeing gold turning into an oil currency. People have been saying, no, it's BRICS currency. It's never going to show up. What's this BRICS currency? Ha, the BRICS didn't do it again. And if you look at what the BRICS are reserving, gold is the BRICS currency de facto. And so I think we're seeing gold being re-reserved as an oil currency, as the BRICS currency. And to me, it's those two things that have really driven that divergence.
I would add to that point by you know, pointing out that if you chart gold price next to U.S. fiscal deficits as a percentage of GDP, That actually matches somewhat closely over the timeline of this chart. So you would have had really big deficits during the global financial crisis. Then they obviously cooled down a bit between that and COVID. Then they blew out in COVID. And then we had this lull in, 2022 or so where the deficits cooled down and now they're reaccelerating again. And we see gold breaking out again. And so kind of my left curve, kind of low IQ take is that it's not, the fiscal deficits are driving it to a significant degree, in addition to all the things that Luke mentioned around just changing geopolitical views on, what you want is your reserve asset for kind of tail risk reasons. If you would have asked me a few years ago, would have I expected a divergence of this big? I would say probably not. And that's from someone who's long gold and not long duration treasuries. And yet I'm still surprised by the magnitude of divergence and the kind of the speed at which this correlation broke down. But I do think it's one of those ongoing signs of just fiscal dominance where interest rates are no longer the decelerator that they are in a environment where there's less public debt. So when there's more public debt, interest rates have a much more mixed outcome of slowing down the economy than they do when you have low public debt and higher private debt or more money creation from the private side.
Can you dive in a little bit deeper there, just for folks who are following along who might not be familiar? Because you hear Chair Powell talk about this in FOMCs every now and again, about this idea of fiscal dominance. And that means something really specific in the minds of policymakers. So can you just define what fiscal dominance is? And then why does the presence of an extremely high amount of debt sort of change things?
Right. So the short answer is it's when fiscal matters a lot more than monetary policy, and it shapes what they can do with monetary policy. Basically, monetary policy becomes, they're less independent, less able to control what they want to do because the fiscal side is such an ongoing issue for them. And the way I kind of characterize that is the difference between the 70s and the 40s. So those are both inflationary decades. When people think of inflation, they always think of the 70s, but the 40s were on average equally inflationary. And in the 70s, most of the money creation was from bank lending. Right, so that was not in any way fiscal dominance. Even though we were running significant fiscal deficits, that was the smaller component. A lot of it was bank lending. So you had a very high money multiplier. You had kind of record sustained issuance of bank loans, large because you had baby boomers entering the home buying years, for example, the kind of peak credit formation years. And so you had the surge in bank loans, surge in corporate bond issuance. A lot of this was private sector driven. And when they wanted to slow that down, because there's all this new money being created from fractional reserve lending, by raising interest rates, they could obviously harm borrowers. They could slow that process down pretty significantly. And even though that did increase federal interest expense, because federal debt to GDP was low, like 30%, it doesn't increase interest expense from the public side as fast as it slows down the private sector. When you go back to the 40s, it was a very different environment because most of the money creation in that era was not from bank lending. It was not from corporate bond issuance. It was from large fiscal deficits. And so you had large monetized fiscal deficits. The central bank and the commercial banking system had to buy most of the bonds. So you got that money multiplier effect, but it was very fiscal driven. And the problem is when you have 100% debt to GDP, if you were to raise interest rates, the interest expense that you generate on the public side would be bigger than the amount of reduction you have on the private sector side. And so that's why public debts matter, because eventually if debts get high enough, you go through the looking glass where higher rates no longer have that kind of firm decelerator aspect that they do in kind of lower public debt environments. And instead it's either more mixed, or in some cases, if it's really imbalanced, it can be an outright accelerator where the additions to fiscal deficits, which are stimulatory, because all that interest expense, all that spending is someone else's income, that can overweight or overshadow what's happening in the private sector side. And I think we're kind of experiencing that to a certain degree, where we're not at the point where it completely overshadows it, but they're roughly on similar magnitudes now. And so you have a much more muted effect from monetary policy than you would have in the 70s compared to fiscal policy.
Yeah, Luke, maybe could I tap you in here? And I mean, any comment on that? I would love to get your sense of whether or not you agree with that accelerator idea that Lynn just laid out. And maybe we could talk a little bit. You know, I've heard you, we were talking a little bit about your interview that you did with Preston and your discussion on Janet Yellen's performance. But it certainly seems like maybe we're at sort of this precipice of fiscal dominance, but it definitely feels like the Treasury has been in the driver's seat, especially as it pertains to the economy, asset markets, et cetera. So maybe you could, I don't know, any commentary on what Lynn just said there, and just would love to get your sense of, you know, how you think the Treasury has been basically doing if you had to grade them over the course of the last couple of years.
So, yeah, I agree with everything Lynn just said. And I thought she said something really important there at the end, which is we're sort of right on the precipice of it. Sometimes we are and sometimes we aren't. I think that's really the critical thing is in my experience, in policymakers in Washington in particular, a lot of the people that have that are very focused on, I think, a very black and white definition of fiscal dominance, either you're in or you're out. We're not to the point where we're all the way in and can't get out. It's always and it's always a question of the different levers, right? So one of the sort of short, easy ways of looking at it that I look at for when we're getting to that point is this dynamic of true interest expense as a percent of U.S. federal tax receipts. So true interest expense, say, okay, what's the gross interest expense? And then I add in the entitlement paygos, because that's just the current portion, the interest portion of your off-balance sheet liabilities for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera. And when you graph that against receipts, what you find is that as that number gets to 100%, where basically you're going to have to print the money to pay the true interest, that has been a very good gauge as sort of a cheap metric on when we get into fiscal dominance. And you can kind of see the impacts of as we near that, the times we've been in, the times we've been out, get very they're predictable, and the way to get out of it's very predictable. So as you near it, you start to crowd out global dollar borrowing markets. The dollar starts to go up. As the dollar starts to go up, you start to see pressure in EMs. You start to see EMs sell treasury bonds to try to raise dollars to defend their currencies, to basically finance their current accounts that are moving from surpluses to deficit. And that treasury selling leads to a net increase in treasury supplies above and beyond what we're getting from the combination of big deficits in the U.S. From Yellen and then QT from Powell. The treasury market gets dysfunctional. Once it gets dysfunctional enough, we see Fed and or Treasury come in and supply more dollar liquidity to calm the treasury market down, because they do not and cannot allow, with debt levels this high, deficit levels this high, the free market to set borrowing rates for the U.S. government. And then we get a weaker dollar. We get a turbocharge in risk assets. We get a bump up in tax receipts on a lag as higher tax receipts come in from higher asset prices. Treasury issuance mitigates. As that happens, the issuance pressure from Yellen weakens. As the dollar weakens, the pressure from foreigners weakens. And in fact, they can turn around and actually buy more treasuries. So we're in this, I thought Lynn making the point of we're not all the way there yet, but we're sort of dancing. We have a foot inside both camps. And there have been times when we've been in one camp entirely and the other camp entirely. And that is very much a function of what the dollar's doing. When the dollar's too strong, we're going into fiscal dominance towards a debt spiral, and we're going to get what we got in 3Q23, which was dollar up, everything else down. You know, the long bond crashed 20% the third quarter. And if they are willing to stand aside, that's what will continue. Now, in terms of, do I think Yellen has done a great job managing a very difficult situation? I do. I think she has. And you can see this. You can see when, particularly last fall, in terms of what she's done with pushing issuance to the front end, making use of the balances in the reverse repo, which was basically just a form of synthetic QE that she didn't need to ask Powell permission to do. and managing the TGA, like I said, in 3Q22. She also, so we've got a tracker. 3Q22, she runs down the TGA. She weakens the dollar pretty dramatically. I mean, 114 to wherever it bottomed, 98 or something like that. In the dollar, that is an enormous move in a 4 or 5 month period of time to keep the Treasury market functioning. Fast forward to the fall of last year, we saw her really November last year shift issuance to accomplish the same thing. And so I think she's done a really good job. I think Treasury, I think she's absolutely aware of the problem. And I think she's absolutely aware of the problem that the way to manage the problem is to manage the level of the dollar. All else equal, the weaker the dollar gets, the less fiscal dominance the U.S. will have. And that's like, it kind of goes back to, you know, a chart Lynn's showed a number of times. She has a great chart just showing, like, once debt to GDP gets as high, you got to have negative real rates for a sustained period of time. And how do you get sustained negative real rates for a sustained period of time? You get the dollar weak enough so inflation picks up, and then you kind of keep rates below that. And that's how you stay out of fiscal dominance. Anytime the real rates get too high because dollar gets too high, you were going to go right back to 3Q23.
Hey, everyone. We partnered with Aura for this episode to keep On the Margin listeners safe from cybercrime. I talked about it at the top of this episode, but cybercrime and phishing scams have basically become the bane of my existence. I get 10 spam calls every single day, every day. I'm sure you guys do too. And my co-founder, Yano, has actually been hacked multiple times, you know, knock on wood, God forbid, this past year. So it's just never been less safe to operate on the internet, especially if you work in crypto. It's particularly tough. That's why we partnered up with Aura, which is an all-in-one app that provides protection for your identity, financial accounts, passwords, devices, all of that stuff. Now, the benefit of Aura, there are many benefits, but one, it's AI. So you immediately get notifications if someone is trying to hack into your bank account, social media, whatever it is. So you know really quick. But in addition to that, what they do is they will actually help you solve the problem. So with 24/7 US-based support and dedicated resolution agents, Aura will actually be there every step of the way to help you resolve whatever is happening on the fraud front. And for a limited time, because Aura just loves On the Margin and you guys as listeners, we are getting a free 14-day trial plus 55% off an Aura subscription when you visit aura.com/blockworks. Only get that discount if you go to aura.com/blockworks, which we've linked in the description. So go check them out. Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Kinto, the safety first layer 2 that is accelerating the transition to the on-chain financial system. Now, I know we're all very excited about tokenization. Larry Fink certainly is. He's on CNBC talking about it all the time. And I know we're all very excited about L2s. Here's the problem though. If we want L2s to onboard the financial system, there's a lot of stuff that we still need. And Kinto is basically rolling out solutions for that. So one, it features user-owned KYC, which is just table stakes for our regulated friends. And if we want the institutional capital to come in, Kinto offers a really good solution for that. They also have native account abstraction that solves some of the largest problems with onboarding in terms of security and user experience today, which is still very confusing. So if we want to bring more folks onto Ethereum, Kinto is the way to do that. And if you believe in this on-chain financial system and you actually want to get more active in Kinto and become a founding member, you should join their launch program, which is Engine. That's ENGN. You can see a link in the show notes. So if you're a part of that, you can do things like participate in Kinto governance, the launch ceremony, and priority access to product launches on Kinto. You get reduced fees and unique discounts on products launch on Kinto. So overall, if you want to be a part of Kinto and the mission that they have, I would go click the link, join the Engine program, and thank me later.
If you two, I was speaking to you not as Lynn and Luke, but instead as, you know, Chair Powell and Janet Yellen. I mean, how are you looking at the situation here? We know that obviously there's a little bit of, maybe you could call it healthy tension sometimes in between the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. Ultimately, they're probably on the same team here. And, you know, this is something that I've heard both of you say a number of times, but I'd be really curious to see, you know, how you think it would actually play out in practice if we were to go down this road of fiscal dominance, which it sort of seems like we're starting to head down. Then it seems like there are a couple of things that needs to happen. There's the dollar needs to go eventually lower. And then it feels like there's this massive, basically, transfer of savings, financial repression, whatever it is, from sovereign bondholders, especially long duration sovereign bondholders, to basically everyone else. And so I'm curious, do you think that's ultimately the end game that we're going down here? Do you think it's not the end game? Like, is there something that we could do to avoid that sort of fate? Or how do you think policymakers are ultimately looking at the current hand that they have to play?
I think obfuscation is a kind of a key method there. And so when we go back to, say, 2019, for example, when the repo rate spike happened, you know, you kind of describe it in financial jargon. You say, look, there's a repo problem. And for people that were kind of paying attention, including Luke, about looking at, you know, like the supply over issuance of T-bills versus, you know, reserves and other kind of sources of liquidity, a lot of people were pointing out that they're going to have to start buying T-bills. And then they had to start buying T-bills. And it's like, well, why are you buying T-bills when you said you were going to be tightening? Right. And you said you're going to be shrinking the balance sheet. And they never say, look, we have to kind of monetize fiscal deficits a little bit here. That's not how you phrase it. You phrase it as put it, you know, you're dealing.
It's not QE. It's not QE.
It's not QE. It's just, you know, and so that's, I think we'll probably see things like that. I mean, for example, you know, fiscal dominance would be less inflationary if it imploded the private sector. So for example, by raising rates so quickly, they blew out interest expense, but they also killed some of the banks. But when those banks started to fail, instead of letting deposits that are uninsured go bust, they bail out the deposits. And so they kind of soften what happens on the private sector while putting the gas on the public side. And that's where you get, you know, fiscal dominance being more inflationary. So it could include things like SLR rules changes, kind of, you know, financial jargon that helps banks hold more treasuries, which is also basically what they did in the 1940s. It wasn't just the Fed monetizing all the treasuries. It was other pools of capital, including banks. And banks, you know, because they have fractional reserve, you know, policies, that they can hold quite a bit of treasuries depending on regulations around them. Especially if those treasuries are shorter term. And so there's all manner of things they can do. Even things like stable coins are now a new source of treasuries that they can kind of just push out there. You know, from the top level, countries are often trying to de-dollarize now around the margins, whereas the people are often not trying to de-dollarize. You don't see, you know, if you go to the currency markets in Cairo, it's dollars. It's not yuan. It's not, you know, yen, it's not everything else, it's dollars. And so in a lot of these different countries, you know, stable coins have over 99% of the market share, is dollars, not other currencies. And so that's basically a new source of demand for T-bills. So I think there's a bunch of little levers they can pull to kind of put treasuries in a lot of different places. And I think that's probably going to be the name of the game for quite a while.
Yeah. I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of stable coins here, but it is funny that there's been such resistance to stable coins from, especially the whispers are treasury, where it seems like, hey, these stable coins actually might be pretty helpful from your perspective here. This is a huge new source of demand to buy these bonds that you're issuing. But one thing that I'd love to get both of your perspectives on, maybe zooming out from the particulars here for a minute. So I don't know if you two have ever read Market Wizards, the Jack Schwager book. I just saw, so it came on Spotify. Spotify now has audiobooks for free, I guess, and you can listen to it. And I went back and listened to this interview that Paul Tudor Jones did back in the late 80s. And honestly, you could take a lot of the things that you and I are talking about today, this sort of runaway fiscal debt spiral. And he was concerned about that back in 1989. Paul Tudor Jones is a really smart guy, has made billions of dollars trading markets. And he was actually so concerned about some sort of imminent collapse back then that he was actually reticent to even go on record because he didn't want to be made a scapegoat, right? If he was the speculator making a ton of money on the collapse of things. And I just say this because I think one of the challenges here is sort of nailing timing. And I think all three of us can sort of look at the situation. I know both of you go back and look at history as well and say like debt is kind of one of these things that ends up not mattering until it really, really matters. And it actually has taken down a number of empires throughout the course of human history. The trick is, when does that cycle ultimately end up kicking in and when does it matter? So I know I'm asking both of you maybe an unanswerable, extremely difficult question, but you know, what sort of quantum are we talking about here? Like if we go down this road of fiscal dominance where we end up monetizing more and more of the debt and do this sort of reset, you know, what is the timeline for that look like? And maybe we could spend some time thinking through some of the second and third order implications of that. Like one of the things that I think you're starting to see is like the rise of populism and stuff like that. So I'm wondering, like, what are the consequences of walking down that road from your perspectives?
Well, I think in terms of timing, obviously, that's always the trickiest part. And so for me, at least, I watch for what I call signposts, right? You start to look for things in the markets. The markets will tell you when it's starting to matter. So, for example, that chart we started with showing gold completely diverging from U.S. real rates. Like, that is a strange chart to a lot of traders and investors in America. You show that chart to an emerging market investor with a lot of experience, it's like it's a chart they've seen over and over and over and over. That's what happens when it starts to matter. Gold goes up when real rates go up in your country, because a rise in real rates, given your debt load, makes your debt load mathematically unsustainable and accelerates you towards a fiscal crisis. So when you see things like that, when you see things like what we've seen for the past 5 years, which Lynn talked about, the repo rate spike, was a treasury supply demand problem, full stop. 3Q20 at, you know, Stan Druckenmiller was on CNBC in 21 talking about this. He said, I've been doing this 40 years. Treasuries have always been a flight to safety in a crisis. And in March of 2020, I saw something I had never seen in my 40 years of doing this, most legendary or one of them investors of all time. The treasury market crashed. The long-term treasury market crashed in the middle of a crisis. His words, not mine. What did the Fed do? $600 billion a week in QE. Treasury market functioning. 3Q22. 1Q23. 3Q23. So we've seen, like, from a timing standpoint, the gold market said, as of 1Q22, if not 3Q22, we have reached the acute phase of the cycle. That's what gold going up with rising real rates means in a current positive and rising real rates. We've seen repeated instances 5 times now in a little over four and a half years. Once the treasury market dysfunctions, Fed and or Treasury come in with dollar liquidity extremely quickly. This, you know, to Lynn's point about softening the blow, if they're willing to stand aside and let these banks not only fail, but let all uninsured deposits go poof, that would have the gold would be closer to where it should be on that real rate chart. That would be deflationary. We would have been out of inflation instantly. Now, we might have touched off a bank spiral. That's a separate discussion, or a bank crisis, but that's a separate discussion. So I think, you know, you can never get the timing right. Like, all this stuff has been obvious forever, but it was only 3Q22 that gold and real rates diverged in the U.S. But once you start to see these symptoms, then you can start to see the incoming data flow as, oh, ISDA is asking for a permanent suspension of SLR requirements for treasuries. The reverse repo. When you see Yellen, I don't think people have been paying nearly enough attention to what Yellen has been saying around these meetings with China. Last week in the Wall Street Journal, Janet Yellen, who is in charge of the dollar, basically came out and said the economic orthodoxy of the last 40 years is over. So does it matter this week, next week? No. But in the same way that when we closed the gold window, it eventually mattered a great deal in the next year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. I think we're going through those motions. You know, it's just these things take time to run through the full scale of history. So, like, I think we're there and it gets started. I think it's accelerating. It can always change depending on a productivity miracle. It can change depending on geopolitics. It can change depending on fiscal austerity, because right now we're kind of too far gone a little bit to fiscal austerity will just make it worse because we haven't gotten debt to GDP down. But it's more about seeing where, you know, using what has happened to kind of extend the path we're on. And then you say, okay, this should happen, this should happen, this should happen, with an understanding of what are the other factors that can change that or accelerate that, and then just watch for them.
So I have a view on timing. I agree with that. And I've pointed out in some of my newsletters the concerns people had in the 80s and early 90s around the debt levels. So for example, the famous debt clock went up in, like, what was it, 1988 or 89. And then Ross Perot ran the most successful independent presidential campaign in the early 90s, largely based on debt and deficit. That was kind of a main issue of his. And so that was like peak zeitgeist of that this matters. And if you look at the chart of interest expense as a percentage of GDP, that was peak interest expense because, you know, even though federal debt was still fairly low, they had ultra high interest rates. And therefore, they had, you know, they looked like they had a spiral starting. Now, they had the fall of the Soviet Union. They had the opening up of China to the world. And then they had this kind of 30-year stretch of major globalization, interest rates falling from double digits all the way down to basically zero. And so, you know, if I were to describe the fiscal problem in one kind of frame, it would be, you know, we've had 40 years of rising debt to GDP, but it's been offset by 40 years of falling interest rates until we hit zero. And so if we just go, you know, sideways now, let alone up, but if we just go sideways now, then we no longer have that offset of interest rates compared to the debt. And a lot of this is locked in. And now we're, you know, we're well over, you know, like 100% debt to GDP. And so I think it's almost ironic. I think basically, because so many people freaked out in the 80s and 90s around the debt and deficit, that they, like a lot of analysts then say, okay, that's kind of like they were, you know, they were way too premature. The lessons we learned is that debts and deficits don't matter. That's how a lot of people took that, right? They say, look, those people were wrong. And
so
I
it's
think
like a little bit of a boy who cried wolf syndrome.
Yeah. And I think, and I think the pendulum has swung so far that now people are in the mindset that debts and deficits don't really matter, and it's starting to matter. And so, for example, you know, we've had the longest period of the Conference Board leading indicator being like in recession territory, and yet not having an official declared recession. We've had, you know, PMIs went down. Normally, bond yields go down when that happens. Instead, bond yields went up. And as Luke pointed out, you know, that chart, you know, gold and real rates diverging. The fact that the Federal Reserve had to come in and stop reducing their balance sheet in 2019 while there's still an economic expansion. These are all kind of things that start happening. And it's not like one Boolean outcome, like, you know, we go from not in fiscal dominance to permanently in fiscal dominance. But over the past, call it 5 years, there's been a number of pretty clear indicators that various signs of fiscal dominance and EM-like characteristics in the U.S. are building. And so I don't think it's a matter of like, okay, here, like 2028 is like the, you know, date that we're going to enter fiscal dominance. My view is basically ever since 2019 or so, we've roughly been flirting with it. That's fiscal is now a bigger factor than it normally is. And we don't have that 40-year offset in lower interest rates to offset that. And if somehow, you know, let's say if AI comes and just completely gives us this massive disinflationary force and just kind of holds down, you know, they're able to have low interest rates despite fairly high money supply growth. Well, then I still want to be in kind of the same assets that I'm in anyway, which I'd rather be in gold and Bitcoin than treasury bonds, for example, in that environment.
I think, Lynn, you made a great point there too with, you know, we had the Soviet Union collapse. We had China get introduced and merge into the world economy. We also had the Plaza Accord, right? Where, you know, the dollar spiked and we basically forced the Japanese, and to a lesser extent, the Germans, into this agreement to strengthen their currencies, put themselves, the Japanese in particular, into a what was supposed to be a decade, then it was 20 years and 30 years, lost 30 lost years by strengthening their currency against ours. And so that's when I say sort of productivity miracles you kind of had in succession, because Lynn, you raise a great point. The last time U.S. gross interest expense as a percent of receipts was as high as it was now was in late 84. And in early 85, the dollar peaked DXY at 166. September, somebody got a heads up because the dollar proceeded to go from 166 to like 120 by the time the Plaza Accord was signed in September of that year. Then it continued to fall for another year and a half to around 85. So the dollar from its spike highs got cut in half in about a 2-year period. That was kind of a productivity miracle. That helped the sustainability of the debt. Then you roll right into the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is also massively deflationary as they are dumping oil into global markets for a lot of the next decade in search of hard currency. We have essentially U.S. puppet governments in Moscow for much of that decade. Obviously, we do not have a U.S. puppet government in Moscow right now. That buys time. That's a productivity miracle. And that's something that can happen. Look, if we get a puppet government to replace Putin and we have a deflationary commodity cycle, that buys time for this. That changes it. That's something we have to watch for. I don't think it's going to happen, but that's the kind of thing. And then you roll China in, you know, same thing. A lot of people say, well, China's going to be the next Japan. Well, to be blunt, contrast the number of military bases the U.S. had in Japan versus in China. It was a whole bunch to zero. The Japan was effectively militarily occupied by the United States at the time we signed the Plaza Accord. It arguably still is to some degree. Same thing with Germany. So we had client states at the Plaza Accord that we were asking nicely to sign a deal with us to buy time. Neither China nor Russia in this case are client states. And China saw what happened to Japan after the Plaza Accord. And there was like zero chance, in my view, and they've sort of said as much, that they're going to engage in that same thing to sort of get us out of our problem. So there are things that can happen. There are things that did happen in the 80s. The other last thing I would point out is there was something Soros called the imperial dollar cycle. He wrote in the FT about it in 84 of this sort of virtuous cycle. The Fed hikes, the dollar goes up, capital flows here, assets go up, inflation goes down, wash, rinse, repeat. And there was a Fed white paper in the end of 2022, imperial dollar cycle 2.0. And saying, hey, we're going to do the same thing. The same thing's going to happen. And demonstrably, empirically, it didn't. U.S. banks broke before China, before any major emerging market broke. What was the difference? In 1984, the U.S. net international investment position was positive 3% of GDP. In other words, we owned more of foreigners overseas, more foreigners' assets overseas than they owned here. So there was massive amounts of capital to repatriate. As the dollar rose and as rates rose, when this white paper of Imperial Dollar Cycle 2.0 was released, the U.S. net international investment position was negative 70% of GDP. In other words, foreigners owned $18 trillion more net of our assets than we owned theirs. Night and day difference versus the 80s. But everyone's saying, well, we'll just do what we did in the 80s. And in terms of getting out of this, we'll just pull the capital back here. The negative 70% of GDP means there is no net capital to pull back here. You strengthen the dollar and foreigners have borrowed a bunch of dollars. Guess what they're going to do? Sell dollar assets and in particular treasuries to repatriate dollars to service their dollar debt. So that too is something that I think is very apples and oranges different versus the 80s relative to now that, you know, people just kind of smooth over, say, well, we were the USA then, we're the USA now, so it'll work out the same. And you have to take a step back and say, well, let's really break down the fundamentals. And when you do that, you say, oh my gosh, like there are some things we could conceivably do. Hey, let's put a puppet in for Putin and let's get commodities on the cheap. Great. Conceivably, that could still happen in terms of the analog to the collapse of the Soviet Union. But like the net international investment position, like that ship has sailed. Those assets are here. If you strengthen the dollar, they're going to leave because they have to, because there's a lot of offshore dollar debt. So it's important to look at the differences now versus then when you sort of compare that to period in time.
Hello, hello, listeners of On the Margin. I've got good news for those of you who are in the crypto scene. Blockworks is bringing back Permissionless. We're going to be doing Permissionless 3, and this year we are heading west. So we're moving that out to Salt Lake City. That's going to be October 9th through 11th. This year, we've got a phenomenal lineup of speakers for you. So we've got Balaji headlining. We've got Sriram Munib, Matt Hogan of Bitwise, Jan Van Eck. This one's going to be a blast, guys. And I saw many of you out in London for DAS this year, and I hope to see you out in Salt Lake for Permissionless. And because y'all are such faithful listeners, we've got, if you use code MARGIN10, you're going to get 10% off your tickets. Appreciate you all. Hope to see you out there.
Maybe we could start to game out some different scenarios here, because maybe taking together this like different relationship that exists between net foreign investment position in the US 80s versus today, and then Lynn, that relationship that you described in terms of the amount of debt that the US has sort of being offset by trending interest rates. Like maybe we could play out some scenarios where those relationships start to reverse. So maybe let's actually start with that one where we could say something like, all right, none of us are geopolitical strategists on here, so I'm not going to try to LARP and predict something. But obviously, there's been tensions that have been ratcheting up between the two largest markets in the world, China and the US. And historically, or at least over the course of the last 40 years, we borrowed an enormous amount of low labor costs from like their labor pool, and maybe that's going to be less available to us. So if that trend were to start to reverse meaningfully, and interest rates started to trend back up because of deglobalization. I mean, how does that ultimately end up manifesting in markets here?
Well, I think that accelerates these trends. If deglobalization, you know, around the margins happens, that makes it increasingly hard for the current system to kind of be structured the way it is. Basically, you'd expect all else being equal, higher inflation because you don't have those disinflationary offsets. And therefore, you'd expect higher bond yields unless they're controlled in some way. And you'd basically get that kind of that repeated spiral that happens. You could get a bank failure, you could get disorderly treasury markets, you could get various things like that. And then they step in, they end QT, they do SLR adjustments, they do some sort of change, and that accelerates some of these things. I think things that can extend it would be things like major new oil discoveries and exploration. Right. So, for example, you know, there's been some new oil fields lately that's been promising. If you have just overall, if you have just kind of more energy come to market than baseline expectations are, that can kind of, you know, push away this issue. You can get by with lower interest rates without necessarily having a inflation spike. And then therefore you can kind of keep an interest expense somewhat manageable for a period of time. The other kind of thing I encounter is that people say, well, here are some other examples of economies that have come down from the brink. You know, they got up to roughly 100% debt to GDP. They were kind of right on the brink and they started getting it down. But one thing that those don't generally have in common is that those are generally not financialized economies. And so there's kind of two components here. If you have a financialized economy, and you don't have a lot of public debt, then you can gradually over time definancialize your economy. On the other hand, if you have a non-financialized economy, but you have a lot of public debt, there's ways to do austerity to lower that debt level without really tanking your economy. The problem is when, you know, the United States is a very financialized economy, which for example means we have got very high wealth concentration, and a lot of that wealth, their income is tied to asset prices. Either because of corporate compensation methods, or because capital gains taxes, all these different levers, are the U.S. tax base is very tied to asset prices, more so than you see in Europe or Japan or other countries, China, for example. And so that makes it so that if they were to try austerity, like let's say they say, look, the entitlement system is unsustainable, the military spending is unsustainable, we're going to try to raise taxes or cut spending or do some sort of combination to pull the deficit down to, 3% of GDP or something. The problem is that the way the U.S. economy is structured, you'd very likely get weaker asset prices, weaker corporate margins, just overall kind of weaker asset prices. Therefore, you'd get kind of a deceleration in U.S. tax receipts, and therefore the fiscal deficit would probably still be roughly as wide. That's a very hard kind of tailspin to pull out of. And so I think that's why the number of moving parts there makes it so that the train is basically set, and then it just becomes a matter of what can accelerate it, what can slow it down, but there's not much that can stop it, is how I would describe it. And around the margins, you invest slightly differently depending on what's going to happen there. But I still think either way, it favors structural money supply growth. And then the question is, does that go mainly into asset prices or mainly into consumer prices or some combination of both? And that's largely going to depend on things like energy abundance, tech abundance, productivity increases. But that either way, investing is fairly similar in those environments.
If I could add something there, Lynn makes a great point. We can see empirically that this has already been proven out. This is no longer speculative, right? So we have the everything bubble in 2021. We have all-time record tax receipts in April 2022. We have the deficit fall to, I think it was $1.3 trillion or $1.4 trillion, down from a peak in around 2020, 2021 of about $3.1 trillion. And you saw the Biden administration and the economists around it saying, look how good a job we've done. The deficit has been normalized, away we go. And then the Fed starts hiking rates aggressively in March of 2022, and asset prices fall, and we see the deficit blow back out. Tax receipts fall in April of 2023, despite the fact that unemployment basically never moved. It basically never rose. And it was all, the swing factor was almost all around two things in terms of the deficit. It was the reduction of tax receipts associated with equity-based comp and capital gains, asset-based comp and capital gains, and the rise in interest rates, which were catching up on a leg. That's got more to go. So much so that by September of 2023, it was fascinating. The end of the U.S. fiscal year, there was a series of articles in sort of the newspapers of record in America, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, in their economics section of, you know, very serious economists saying, whoa, we've never seen this before. The deficit just nearly doubled without a recession, without a rise in unemployment. What happened here? And something must be really wrong. And, you know, Lynn and I at the time were sort of saying the whole time, like, the deficit's going to blow back out when you're doing this because of all the reasons Lynn laid back out. And then it did. And so while it wasn't surprising to us, I think it was very important empirical proof of what Lynn just described. And I think it's also important as we talk about this concept of this train, nothing stops this train, as Lynn has taken ownership of, rightfully so, which is, now they know, right? It's a lot of this is the common knowledge game, right? Is when do we know? When do they know? And then when do we know they know? And so like we knew this was going to happen, but they didn't until September of last year. And now we know that they know. And if we know they know, then they're not going to try. They know that can't work. The whole higher for longer austerity, they've had the fear of God put in them. They know what's going to happen if they try. And so what's that? That's a very powerful piece of knowledge as an investor, because now you can step back and go, oh, we know they know. They can't try it again. So you need a productivity miracle, or else we're just going to stay on this track. So like, they will supply liquidity every time it's needed. The other thing I think is really important is the productivity miracle can't arrive too fast. It can't arrive too slow. And it can't arrive too fast. In other words, if AI shows up and over the next 3 years takes 20% of the white collar jobs, like, that's too fast. You're going to have unemployment go up. You're going to have wages drop. And because by virtue of the debt to GDP and deficits being as high as they are, you're going to blow out the deficit. And that's going to make it worse. They're going to need to reserve more of the debt. And when I say reserve more of the debt, fully reserve, it's they're going to have to go back to QE in some form or another. And so it's the debt is a very, very, you know, the debt and deficits, they matter again in a big way, to tie back to earlier.
Yeah, I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole of AI, but I would, you could count me in the bucket of being a long-term extreme optimist about AI, but a short-term extreme skeptic, because like, just if you just look at the CapEx cycle that NVIDIA or companies like NVIDIA are going through of building all this stuff out, I mean, it is massive, the amount of dollars that are getting spent.
One add-on is that I think it'll take time as well. But I would point out that unlike social media and kind of shift from, you know, edge computing to cloud computing, this is more energy intensive technology. It's more of that software plus hardware combination. And so you could have a situation where, you know, we kind of like the past while has been goods disinflation, but service inflation, right? And that's kind of the structural period we've been in. You could get a reversal. You could get disinflation in various kind of white collar services because we're getting so much more productive at them. At the same time as we're not really getting energy disinflation. We're not really getting, you know, disinflation in kind of the electrification metals, for example. There could be that more physical cycle that happens. And so that's kind of how I view it, is that I try to invest in such a way that I don't have to be too accurate about the speed of AI adoption and displacement. I don't want to be completely off sides, but because it's not my core expertise, I'm kind of monitoring that. I'm a user of it, but I try to structure it in a way that doesn't dramatically affect my thesis or my investments.